When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to Conversations with the Voice of Reason. I'm your host, Benjamin Boyce, and today's conversant is Simon Maya Price, who was on my show a few years ago with his father, and in that show he was under the pseudonym Ash, and I found that that particular conversation was very fascinating and hopeful because it displayed the relationship between a father and a son, a teenager and a father, and it had to do with gender and autism. And I've wanted to have them back on just to chart the progress and see how things are developing in their lives. And Simon reached out to me independently a couple weeks ago, and so we had a conversation talking about where he is now at 19. As opposed to 16. And we talk a lot about autism and his ways of coping with the way that his brain processes information. And we talk about his worldview and what he's doing with his life. And, you know, just a generally, the kids are going to be all right kind of conversation. Great guy. He does a lot of music. You can find that linked in the description below, along with links to a tip jar if you want to support the channel. And if you want to support the channel, consider liking and subscribing. Without further ado, here is Simon Maya Price.
Hello.
Hey. How are you doing there?
I'm doing all right. How are you?
I'm good. It's been a while.
Yeah, I'm about, it's been 3 years and about 40 pounds, so.
40 pounds, huh?
Yeah.
I reached out to your dad a couple times. He said that he kind of, I don't remember, he said that you'd kind of gone down different paths since then.
Yeah, I mean, my dad and I are still pretty close, but... we agree on like most of stuff, and I just kind of want to do this myself because I feel like last time it's a different conversation with and without my dad, you know?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
I want to do this from, it's me talking about my things. And I'd be happy to have a follow-up with my dad, you know, if I can get him to do that.
Yeah.
And I'm sure he would be happy to do that. But, you know, it's just different.
What's your age now?
I'm 19.
You're 19. We were 16 when you were 16 when we spoke.
Yeah, I'm turning 20 June 2nd.
Oh, wow. Here we go.
Yeah.
I have to say that the conversation with your dad was so... very special to me because it really showcased a father and a son, and I'd never done an interview where a father and a son are interacting, so it was just very special. Mm-hmm. But the trade-off with that is that, you know, you don't get a picture of you, you don't get a picture of him, you get a picture of you too, so it's good to just give you a space. But I also have to just say how much I appreciated you two coming on.
I appreciate you having us. I think that was probably, like, when I look back at my life and I'm like, what are the things I'm the most proud to have done? That was one of those things.
Oh, really?
Huh. Yeah, because, you know, that reached a lot of people and a lot of people really resonated with it.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'll take the W there.
Well, speaking of W's, what are some of your more recent wins and losses?
Yeah. Oof. A lot of stuff has happened over the past 3 years. We're recording. Yeah.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Not?
Yeah. So I started Berkeley. I'm three and a half years into that.
Wow. Okay.
Berkeley College of Music specifically.
Okay. Is that in Berkeley, California, or is that something different?
Boston.
Okay. All right.
Berkeley College of Music, which is with two E's as opposed to EY. Very commonly confused.
It's important because Berkeley EY has a very particular
ideology that might be or might not be shared by EE Berkeley.
Yeah, yeah. But both are very well, you know, renowned universities. Berklee College of Music is very well internationally known as basically the best school in the world for contemporary commercial music. And what I mean by that is my classmates are like, I'd say 30, 40% foreign, so not U.S. citizens, from everywhere. You know, there's a lot of, in the U.S., a lot of like Chinese exchange students. It's not just all Chinese. We have a lot of Chinese students, but we also have lots of South American students. We have lots of European students. We have Australian students. We have, you know, African students. We have Caribbean students. We have Japanese, Korean, Israeli, you know, everything. Basically, a lot of countries are represented at Berklee, and that's been really interesting socially and culturally, and I've learned a lot from that. And that means we have so many cool types of music as well.
What's your music?
Yeah, so the kind of music I've been doing is, I want to say, indie pop rock. And I mix in some punk, and I mix in some sort of Latin influences. So, you know, in the middle of my punk set, I'll play a bossa nova song.
Yeah.
And I'll play it in an instrumentation of a punk band. So, you know, I'm singing and playing guitar, and I have my bassist, and I have my drummer, and I have my keys player, right? And yeah. And then even in my more rocky stuff, a lot of the bass lines I write are more typical of maybe salsa, or have little, you know, maybe I'll take a chord progression that's typical of a flamenco tangos, right? And so I just put everything together and see what happens, and people mm-hmm. seem to like it when I play it live. So yeah.
Are you like the lead of your band slash group, or is it an ensemble, or what?
I do like performances and businesses and marketing and business and marketing and all that as Simon Amaya Price, which is just my name. Mm-hmm. And so, for example, I have a gig on April 2nd at O'Brien's Pub in Alston, 8:00. If you want to come, any viewers in Boston, on the poster, it says, you know, this band B, Simon Amaya Price, and then, you know, Doors, etc.
Yeah.
And so when it says Simon Amaya Price, that includes my band members.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
And you, from what I recall, you were starting to go towards drumming. Was that the thing that you started with your studies specifically in music?
My studies drumming in music have been so eclectic and over a decade that I think at that time I was practicing a lot of drums, and I was practicing for a proficiency exam at Berklee on drums, which I didn't end up doing, but I did end up doing one on bass. So that meant that at Berklee now, I'm a voice principal and a bass secondary, which means that I was able to do ensembles for credit as a bass player.
Okay. And what do you do with your vocals?
I sing. I write songs. I do a lot of production. And when I perform, I'm singing mostly.
Okay. But what are you singing about?
I'm singing about sort of my life and my experiences.
Okay.
I write a lot of my songs are about, you know, one ex or the other, specifically the ex, right? As is very typical of musicians, you know, Taylor Swift is ridiculously successful, and every song, you know, is about one of the exes. So I'm kind of following in her footsteps in that small way.
Tried and true.
Yeah. I also, you know, touch upon like topics of, you know, gender nonconformity and mental health and depression and things like that. Mm-hmm. And I also try to weave in this sort of line of TV and film metaphors and analogies. So, in
a lot of references to The Wire and Sopranos and stuff.
I referenced my favorite TV show Community.
Ah.
So, for example, in the third verse of my song Manic Pixie Dream Boy, which itself is a film TV trope reference, it starts 6 seasons and a movie. That's how much you meant to me. Yeah. And if you remember Abed from Community, you know, had a few lines where he would say 6 seasons and a movie, you know, referencing the show he was in, thus breaking the third wall.
Did they ever make the movie? They didn't make the movie.
They're making it.
Oh, they are.
They
oh,
announced
really?
It like a couple months ago or like last
oh,
year or something.
Okay. Well, that's good to know.
Yeah. I'm really excited for that.
I watch that show every few years. It is very reminiscent of my alma mater, the Evergreen State College, just in
yeah.
the amount of dysfunction and wackadoodliness in the show and at the college. So.
Yeah, it reminds me of my first college, which I get to say now, Bard College at Simon's Rock.
Bard.
So when I was in my previous interview with you, with my dad, this was the first college I went to when I was 16, right?
Yeah.
And that's where I had a lot of negative experiences around a lot of social justice and far left students who made threats against me. And so Community kind of reminds me of that a little bit, because there was lots of wackadoodle stuff and it was this very small, you know, place in the woods, you know, but
yeah,
very chaotic.
Was that experience before or after our interview, our first interview?
I believe it was before.
Okay.
I think I had just left.
Okay.
And
that's
just
where
started
you
Berkeley.
Were kind of transed, or like some sort of counselor was sending you off.
That was so the timeline is my first trans identification was ninth grade. And then there was 10th grade and I kind of persisted in that. And then I went to college after 10th grade at Bard College at Simon's Rock. Right.
Yeah.
And so there I was kind of in this gray area where I started to really realize, hey, I hate all of these people and they're using this identity as a reason to be absolute jerks.
Mm-hmm.
And do things which are sort of very against, I'll say, you know, classical liberal values, which I'm personally a big fan of.
Yeah.
Yeah, and another thing about Bard College at Simon's Rock is it's a subdivision of Bard College. Bard College has a whole bunch of different subdivisions for different things. They have like one specifically for prisoners. They have some like pilot high schools here and there. But Bard College at Simon's Rock is especially interesting because it's specifically for, so you don't need a high school diploma to get it, because it's specifically for early college students who are leaving high school early or maybe even never went to high school. And so I was with a lot of kids who were actually my age, despite the fact that I was going to college early.
Mm-hmm.
Another interesting thing about that is I think that's actually one of the contributing factors to why it was so radically far left. I remember after I left, that's actually where my parents went as well.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I got legacy preference or not. I'll never know. Either way, I'm happy it happened the way it happened, even though it was awful. But you know, my parents and I found out like last year or the year before that they launched a new job training program there, which, you know, a lot of people really pushed for, because it's like, we're isolated, we're being taught these, you know, liberal arts subjects, which, you know, how are we translating this into a job? Can we get internships? Not really, because it's in the Berkshires, right? And the job training thing is for, I think it was LGBTQ leadership.
Oh, that's the job now?
And that's their first job training program. And we're looking at this, but something like that. And we're like, yeah. What the heck? This makes no sense. Is this a job?
I guess there's a lot of LGBTQs in search of a leader, or lots of leaders.
I guess so. I think that might be a thing. Another thing about that college is that there are some statistics, and I think 70% of the students who go there identify as somewhere in the LGBTQ acronym,
yeah.
Which is ridiculous. Like, that's crazy.
It's what all the unique artsy types are doing now. Nowadays.
Yeah. So that was, that was an interesting experience.
Yeah. You know, one aspect of our previous conversation that was surprising or unexpected was we kind of dipped into an autistic diagnosis of you and your experience mm-hmm. with hypersensitivity and then getting diagnosed with some really interesting tests and doing modules or something to manage that. What do you think about autism as a diagnosis for you? And is it something that you grew out of? Because you don't seem at all, you seem very amicable and tuned into your humanity and very direct with me. So I'm wondering if that was just a stage of your development. What do you think about that?
Yeah. People have said sort of similar things to that effect to me before. I think that to answer that question, we kind of have to review what context we're talking about and what different words mean in those contexts, right? I hate to be this way, but autism is a societal construct, right? Okay. Which doesn't mean it doesn't exist, right? That's the postmodernism sleight of hand, is that if it's a social construct, therefore it doesn't exist. But yeah, that's not what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. In the DSM-5, right, which is the sort of diagnostical statistical manual of psychological disorders, the specific diagnosis is autism spectrum disorder. And there's a list of bunch of different things. And it's like, you have to cross out X number of these Y number of things to be diagnosed with this. And it needs to cause a negative impact in your daily life. I could not tell you whether or not the numbers I still meet. I think that my diagnosis would look different than it did when it was done, when I had it done.
Which was what? How old were you when that was first?
I was just newly turned 15 or 16, I believe.
Okay.
So recently, before we had our interview last time. Mm-hmm. And so what I've done since then, right, is the point ultimately of a diagnosis is to target treatments. And also to say to insurance companies, hey, this is why you should give us money.
Yeah.
And so it did both of those things pretty well, I'd say. But so I still am a person who has a lot of hypersensitivity. I still have a lot of difficulty with social situations. Mm-hmm. You know, there are a lot of ways in which I'm reminded in certain situations, like doctor's offices, airports, train stations, whenever I have to do anything involving the government, like renewing a passport, in those moments, I'm like, wow, I'm really autistic, because these are unusual situations. And I have a really difficult time handling unusual situations and change in routine, which is part of the classic autistic thing. And also social interactions that I haven't been able to plan out in detail beforehand. That's what.
How many times have you practiced this interview?
I have been. So the way I practiced this interview is basically ever since I started thinking about maybe doing it, which was like a week or two ago, maybe, I started thinking in my head throughout the day, sort of ruminating, what am I going to say? What is he going to ask? What do I want to talk about? I actually wrote a lot before this interview.
Just to get it all kind of in your RAM kind of stuff.
I think that as well, a lot of people will ask me, this is going to sound really a little bit conceited and maybe a bit stuck up, but I'll have conversations occasionally and with new people usually. they'll ask me, how do you know so many things? How are you able to articulate them in this way? And if you just write them down beforehand, your brain kind of remembers them in a special way and filters them out. And then you can talk, you know, concisely. You sort in a way that emphasizes the most important parts and de-emphasizes things which you don't remember. So it's like, you know, putting everything through a sieve of your memory.
Yeah. Before we move on, can we just expand on what you, well, I guess you did cover social situations specifically with the unknown and then how you prep for that, but like hypersensitivity, how does that affect you? Like, what does that mean?
I obviously haven't answered your question to the fullest extent. I was sort of just touching on what things presently are still obvious to me that are affecting me. With hypersensitivity, that's things like airports. That's things like train stations. I can't handle loud sounds without ear protection, which is really funny. As a musician who works as, I get paid to do music and I plan to do that for the rest of my life, I can't stand most concerts because they're too loud, even when I have earplugs. And so I've been in a lot of situations where I've been invited to a concert or I got tickets to a concert of an artist I absolutely love. And, you know, I have my bag with me, for example, and I have my headphones in my bag because I'm going to wear my earplugs and my headphones at the same time. And I remember I was going to see Cave Town at the House of Blues with my ex like 1 or 2 years ago, 2 years ago, two years ago. Yeah. And I got stopped at the door and they're like, what's in your bag? And I'm like, I have a water bottle and I have my headphones. And they say, oh, you're not allowed to bring a bag in. I'm like, really? I can't have my bag for my headphones and my water bottle? And the guy at the door gives me a hard time about it. But eventually this lady who works there as well comes up and I say, hey, I'm autistic. I have my headphones and I can't really experience this concert without having a breakdown without my headphones. And, you know, she let me in because she understood, apparently, or appeared to understand. And I actually got stage side seats at this concert, which was really nice because I got to be outside of the crowded part. So yeah, I'm super sensitive when it comes to auditory stuff and smells as well. I'll also touch upon the difference you see from now to 3 years ago, right? Or 3 years ago to now, rather. I've done a lot of work because the first step, I had just completed the first step, right? I had identified a problem. I was able to articulate the problems I was having more adequately through an autism diagnosis, right? And that's kind of what I talked about. It's like, whoa, I realize this is the problem. I have a name for it. This is how it affects me. It affects other people too. I'm not alone in that. And so since then, I've had a lot of interactions with other autistic people. I've done a lot of research and I've done a lot of work with my therapist through this lens. So I've been able to aggregate a whole bunch of data. And the most important things I've learned are, I think number one, emotions are really useful. 3 years ago, probably, if you asked me, what are the purpose of emotions? I'd say, I don't really know, to keep you alive. And that's kind of an unsophisticated answer. Really, if you think about it, and you're really sort of mindful of it, emotions, yes, they keep you alive. Fear keeps you alive. That's super, you know, great. You know, happiness after you eat something that encourages you to eat more, right? But what about things like envy and guilt and anger, even when they, like, there's no direct line to why this helps me survive when I get angry at my dad for putting my coffee cup in the wrong place? Like, that that's not a life or death thing. But what I realize is my therapist, I might have talked about this last time, but my therapist gave me this sheet with the names of all the emotions, the purposes of the emotions, what the emotions tell you to do. So with anger, for example, What I've learned, and I've kind of graduated beyond the sheet now because I have a more nuanced understanding of it. So anger, for example, is usually a reaction to an infringement on your boundaries. And what anger gets you to do is it gives you the motivation to protect your boundaries, right? And that's one case. And that's really important because as an autistic person, it's like I can kind of vaguely feel that I'm feeling this emotion, but it's very difficult for me to figure out what it's telling me to do and why I'm feeling it. But if I know that, hey, this is anger, that means that it's likely that a boundary is being crossed and that I need to protect that boundary, then I'm less angry, number one, because the anger has done its job of communicating what I need to do to me, right? And then in situations where my emotions are telling me information that I don't logically realize, I can then make a more, we call it a wise-minded decision going forward there. And so that's just with one emotion, and building that skill set and bringing it to the present, you know, if you, there's a graph of improvement and it's rather exponential. And so that means that's just useful in every element of life, every part of life. Secondly, what I've learned as well is that I've struggled a lot as well with depression and anxiety. And those things kind of feed off of being autistic, because if I'm anxious, right, I just said that, you know, maybe I can feel that I'm anxious, but what's the anxiety telling me to do? Why am I feeling it? These are questions that aren't clear to me, right? Answers that aren't clear to me. And same thing with depression. It's like, I just feel bad. And I kind of accept that. I'm like, there's nothing I can do with it. But that's not true, right? What I realize is that I've learned the set of skills to get from, I am so depressed and anxious that I am stuck in my bed and I can't do anything, to within like a day or two doing the things I need to do. And that's really, really major for me. And the origin of action, any action really, is perception. And when you're autistic and your perception of your internal emotional state, which is called alexithymia, right? Alexithymia is the difficulty with the perception of your own emotional state, right?
Okay.
That your ability to perceive as a precursor to action is sort of the stopping point. Like once I figure out what I need to do, I can figure out how to do it. I can do it really, really effectively. I can out-research anyone. I can outwork everybody if I'm really motivated to do it. But figuring out how to perceive accurately means that I can get from depression and anxiety, which I relapse on from time to time, which, you know, still interacts with the fact that I am autistic and I do have these issues and it's not completely automatic, to getting back to normal. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I'm trying to find a baseline, because what you're describing is just basic coping mechanisms that I think everybody develops insofar as they want to develop their ability to be self-aware and then to be effective in the world. But you are stressing the procedural nature of it more. It's not as intuitive. And maybe the question would be, if you can describe it, how you don't understand your emotional state. Is it like this stream of data, like the Matrix movie where the guy's just looking at the screen and it's just like a bunch of like bits and bobs, but you don't really know how to decode it? Like you feel something, but you look at it as an object, or because it's not an object, you can't grasp it as easily as.
So I think an analogy is in order here, which, yeah. I'm going to sort of refine a little bit. Imagine you're in a pool and you're blindfolded and you're deaf and you're kind of floating around and you keep bumping into things and you can't really tell what you're bumping into. And maybe you bump into one thing and it's hard. And it's like, is this a wall? Is this a step? Is this a rock? Is this a brick? You can't really tell. And so you can't. It was like, okay, there's a thing. What is it? I don't know. That's kind of how it feels most of the time, in terms of on the emotional front.
Okay.
And so basically that's pretty crippling, because most people, they can just look at the brick and they're like, oh, that's a brick. That means it has, you know, XYZ properties.
Yeah. Yeah. They might not be deft at knowing what to do with a brick, but it's like, that's anger. That's sadness. Yeah. Whereas you, it's like, what is this thing? It's kind of sluggish and making me see things negatively. Do you have to like reverse engineer like by like
yes,
the effect?
Exactly. Okay. So yeah, my example with the sort of three questions I can ask about like the name of the emotion, the purpose of the emotion, what the emotion is telling me to do.
Yeah.
I could get only one or part of one of those three things. Right. I almost never get the name of the emotion first. What I get is I have the strong urge to do a thing. And then I have to be like, okay, I have a strong urge to do a thing. Can I connect this to an emotion? And so I have to ask, okay, if what emotion tells me to do this sort of thing? Then I can be like, okay, maybe it's anger, right? Because I'm being told by my mind to protect my boundary. Or okay. Yell at somebody, for example.
Yeah.
Right. It's not immediately obvious what it is.
Huh. What's fascinating is that you want to devote your life, and you have devoted your life, to music, which is, from a certain point of view, very emotional, highly emotional. I'm wondering what's the relationship between that? What's the relationship between you and the audience via music? What is the relationship between you and music as a creative endeavor? And how does that feed into what you're talking about like, how do you make an angry song? Or do you write a song? You're like, oh, that's an angry song. You know, like, what's the procedure when you're doing music? Or is music is completely a way for you to integrate all these different aspects of you that in your cognitive function, when you're doing something social, is really difficult and you need to rely on procedure. But is music theory the same thing as this emotional procedure, or is it completely different realm?
Yeah. Music is like cognitive behavioral therapy. Cognitive behavioral therapy is predicated on this model of logical mind, emotional mind. Where they intersect is called the wise mind. For me, music is the same thing. There's procedure, there's logic, there's this chord goes here,
yeah,
and this is how I technically execute this thing and produce and mix it. And then there's the emotional part, and the synthesis of the two is really, really good music. And music for me has always been both a coping mechanism for my alexithymia and very strong emotions, because I feel emotions very strongly. That doesn't necessarily mean I immediately know what they are.
Yeah.
And as an intellectual pursuit. And when those are sort of the two strongest, perhaps, parts of my mind, strongest motivating parts of my interior mental landscape, I can, putting them together is like, whoa, I get really interesting stuff. So yeah, like you said, I can write a song and I kind of just, you know, write down the lyrics and the chords and play it on my guitar or the piano or whatever. And I'm like, oh, this is an angry song. I'm angry about this. I see it now.
Mm.
And a lot of my songs, I'll write, like a lot of the songs I've been playing lately live originally were jazz songs, because I'm like, I can't be angry. Why would I be angry? This isn't an angry song.
Mm.
And then I realize, like 2 weeks after I write the song, oh, I am angry about this.
Okay.
And then maybe I'll restyle it as a more punk and rock song. And that's how the song ends up.
Yeah. The origin of the word autism is from auto or self. And I think that there's like, when they were diagnosing it, they were, especially in the extreme cases, noticing that there's this inability for this one human to connect with other humans, or being very locked away inside of themselves, especially with the more extreme stuff, or side of the spectrum. That being said, what about as you've been developing 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, prime time for you to, you brought it up yourself, have an ex or have a current, be connected with somebody, feel connected to somebody. What is the process of you being with others and, developing into? And I'm still figuring out myself. I'm not 20, 30 years older than you about. So, it's not like you're ahead or behind. I'm sure you're ahead in some ways, and I'm ahead in other ways. But I'm wondering how that journey has been and how music fits into that, how these different tools that you've found work into that.
I would be lying if I said that it hasn't been very, very difficult for me to start friendships, maintain friendships, even start friendships and sort of relationships of any kind.
Is it because of like a mutual activity or like you can
So
have a relationship via a mutual activity or via the relationship having itself?
my main sort of route of creating and sustaining relationships is intellectual conversation. And my longest friendship at this point is with I won't name his name, but he graduated from Northeastern late recently, and he's a computer science programmer, and he works as part of a startup. And like once a month, we sit down and we have sushi, and we talk about whatever thing, we're interested in, like the economy or intersexual dynamics or, the rise of Mao in China or something like that, right? And for me, that's pretty ideal. And I consider him one of my closest friends. For most people, that's not at all what a friendship looks like. From what I've realized, the people who are around me, that's not what they're expecting when they're looking for a friendship. I need to spend a lot of time alone, like most of my time.
What?
And I can, so why? I find social interaction absolutely exhausting.
Okay.
Any social interaction. It could even be with somebody I am like head over heels in love with. I still need a break, and I'll just like my brain shuts down after,
Okay.
X
Yeah.
number of hours or X number of days.
It's not
I know that.
easy just being with someone. You're always going through these
Yeah.
procedural.
Absolutely. Also, a lot of friendships lately have ended over political disagreements.
That might be your generation. Like, who the hell cares about if we agree or disagree? What, why has that become the unit of exchange of friendships? Like, do we agree? Do we disagree? Do we agree to disagree, or do we disagree to agree? I don't know. It's just such a flimsy way of making human connection. But it might not just be your generation. I think the entire internet facilitates that.
Absolutely.
Sorry to interject.
Yeah, no problem. That's actually something I wanted to talk about is like I have my own problems, but I also see other people's problems way clearer than I see my own problems. One of the, on the political disagreements thing, I've found, maybe this is just me tooting my own horns, so take this with a grain of salt, but I seem to be the most politically tolerant one and most rooms full of people my age I talk to. So I have never ended a friendship intentionally by saying, oh, you disagree with me on XYZ issues, we can't be friends. I've never said that.
That doesn't
That
make
doesn't
sense
make
to you.
sense to me.
Why does it not make sense to you? I'm just interested in that because that's not how I look at relationships too, or I look at it.
So as I mentioned before, the way I build friendships, first and foremost, is on intellectual discussion. Part of discussion is debate. If you disagree with me on something, I love it. Okay. Because that gives me an opportunity to talk to somebody and sort of, we can test our ideas off of each other.
Okay.
Right. Yeah. For me, learning and understanding is a dialectical process, which means that we have the thesis, we have the antithesis, and we have the synthesis.
And your identity doesn't rest inside of your opinions.
Exactly.
You can see opinions and thoughts as something distinct from yourself. I think that that's one reason why people make and break friendships on that, because they identify with those things.
Yes, and that doesn't mean I don't have my shortcomings in terms of opinions and identity.
Yeah. We can get into that later if you want to.
Yeah, totally, totally.
I like to see where my own and other people's ideals break down. It's always kind of fun.
Yeah. I think that one of the things that Simon's Rock taught me a lot is that I was surrounded by smart kids, because these are all kids who went to college early, right? Part of it's self-selecting. Part of it is if you're not like pretty smart, you can't get in. Smart people do a lot of really stupid stuff. I'm assuming I can't swear.
You can swear if you want to.
okay. Noted.
If it helps.
And one of the things that you learn when you watch smart people do stupid shit is you realize that, wait a minute, even if I think I'm smart, maybe I'm dumb, or maybe I'm smart, but regardless, maybe I do stupid shit too. And so I think it's super duper important whenever we see somebody making a mistake to look in on ourselves and be like, are we making the same mistake here? And I think that it's the most intellectually honest thing to do, to say, yes, we can identify this issue, and we can also identify this issue within ourselves. And I think that's one of the big issues I see in a lot of political conversations. Is that, you know, I'll see like a conservative and a liberal or progressive having a debate, because that's the, you know, archetypical thing that we see now. And, you know, maybe the progressive is like, oh, we need to get the kids to transition if they want to. And I identify with this, and death or high, come high or low water, whatever the saying is. And then the conservative will be like, you're so awful. But in that context, the conservative is identifying with his opinion just as much as the progressive. And if we want to work together and engage in a dialectic, whether or not the thesis or the antithesis are correct and have solutions, we can't be stuck in that identification. You know, being of one political persuasion or the other doesn't mean that you're not falling into the same cognitive biases that everybody else.
Well, yeah, but not all, I'm going to disagree with you. Not all cognitive biases are created equally. Just for example, it's either in the United States, there are different states, and different states have different mores or, you know, ethics that they want to create policy out of. One contentious issue today is this notion of the trans kid. California says it is child abuse not to transition a child. Florida says it is child abuse to transition a child. It is either child abuse to or not to transition a child. Like there's like, so one set is right and one set is wrong. So how do we come to the conclusion of that? Not both sides can't be right. Maybe they can have bad reasoning on both sides. Both sides could have equally fallacious reasoning. But the conclusion is either the, you know, the manipulation of children via permanent medical procedures based on a notion of gender identity is true or it's not true.
Yeah.
For example.
Yes, I agree with that.
Yeah.
I agree with that, but you know,
and then when you're talking about children, it is, I see children, it's not, it's justified to have very strong feelings about that, that those feelings don't justify bad reasoning, but it is very justifiable. That's a primal and it's civilizational to protect the children.
Yes, I completely agree. the way I got to where I am, I was once very, very progressive. I once thought I was trans myself, right? Is that I was looking at all of these people who made arguments against being trans. And I'm like, what mistakes are they making? Because I must be right. And so I found all the mistakes they were making. And maybe they were making a lot of mistakes. There were a few mistakes, but they were right about a lot as well. And by looking for the mistakes, you realize how right somebody is. And so when I look at these people, a lot of them are very, very intelligent. And I see that they're making mistakes, but maybe they're still right about some stuff. I look at myself, because if a smart person can make a mistake, somebody who's very accomplished, that means I can make a mistake. And if you look honestly at the mistakes you yourself are making, that will get you closer to the truth, right? And so it's not about the process that I'm trying to describe will get you closer to honesty and to truth, right? Even if there isn't really an equivalency between the two sides, right? Am I explaining this well enough?
No, we're playing around. I find it engaging. I don't know how well any given listener is going to understand or not understand it. I can't pretend to speak to them, but it's interesting to see your dedication to the truth and to procedure and how that is something you just
that's
said.
Super autistic, by the way.
It alienates you. Yep. And that's autistic. Yeah.
Yeah. Super autistic. Black and white thinking, which is kind of related to what I'm talking about, and sort of, you know, the auto didact, auto, you know, thinking, all of that stuff. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. The reason I think this way is because I spent so much time with myself,
yeah,
thinking about processes and how things can be the most efficient and how things can be as accurate as they can be and as true as they can be. And if I was instead going around and having what I would say a normal childhood, playing with other kids all of the time and doing school and all that, I don't think I would have the outlook I have today. If I were not
autistic,
I would
be creature.
Very different. Yeah, yeah, I'd be more of a
bird animal.
Creature.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'd be doing emotions first and then procedure, yeah. You know, and that's the problem actually, right? People do emotions first, then they're like, we have to do this because I feel this way.
Right? If they're honest enough to say that, then yes.
that's what a lot of people do. Yeah. And right, on the trans issue specifically, right, I obviously believe that children should not have the ability to be transitioned or, you know, be put under surgeries or any hormones or anything like that, because that's obviously ridiculous. And we have a lot of evidence, and I can say that very clearly. And I say that not because I feel that way and then looked for evidence, but because I found evidence that said, wait a minute, this is bad and it doesn't work, right? Because I initially felt the opposite way, right? And so the issue that a lot of progressives make and a lot of people who identify as trans, as I myself made, is I felt like I was not the sex I was born, right? Or I felt like if I were trans, that would make my life better. If I underwent these surgeries or these hormones, that would make my life better, right? And then I looked for evidence to back me up, right? I could say, oh, the study says I'm right. And then once I read the line of the study that said I'm right, I would not read the rest of the study, right?
Mm-hmm.
And sort of the switch I made, which I made because of sort of the person I am and because I was really interested in mathematics and science, the switch I made is, okay, let's read the statistics. Let's really honestly look at this so that I can defend my opinion better, right? But then in trying to be able to defend your opinion better, sometimes you realize you were wrong. That's really embarrassing. And so...
Is embarrassment an emotion or...
Yes.
Yeah.
Embarrassment is either some combination of guilt and shame. And I can tell you the purposes of both those things and what those feel like if you want.
But you want to avoid being embarrassed.
Being embarrassed and being guilty and being ashamed are not fun. I think that embarrassment is kind of like a composite emotion. It's kind of like green, as in like green is a combination of yellow and blue.
Okay.
I see it as a combination of shame and guilt. And what shame tells you to do is, what or tells you is, there's something inherently wrong with me and I need to hide, right? That's what shame is. That's a really counterproductive emotion in the vast majority of cases, right? Sometimes, like if I'm, you know, gay in a society where I'll be killed for being gay, that shame will keep me alive.
Yeah, it's
right. It's not without its use, but, and that's why it's there, but it's not great, especially when it's unregulated. Guilt, on the other hand, is more action-based. So it says, I am worse because I made this particular action. You know, people become guilty after they make a bad decision. And that guilt tells them to never make that same decision again. And that can cause issues when it's too much. And
yeah, or if you can't
embarrassment.
Let it go. Yeah.
So when we talk about embarrassment, it's some combination of those two. It's there's something inherently wrong about me, or I made the wrong decision here, something like that. And that's very difficult to work through. Yeah, so I want to go back to my point about emotions, then logic, right? Is that, right, progressives see in the news, right? I can read the newspaper or a magazine or something, and I'm like, oh, kids who aren't given gender-affirming care kill themselves more. Emotion. And then based on that emotion, on, you know, information which isn't even quality, isn't even good data necessarily, it's just somebody's opinion, but shapes my perception of how the world is, then I feel emotion. Then I look for more evidence to validate that emotion, right? And then I go forth and, you know, fight on the basis of that. And you're not going to be able to convince somebody who's doing that on the basis of their emotion. A lot of conservatives do the same exact thing, even though maybe they're right, or classical liberals and centrists and people who don't agree with this stuff, right? I'll see, oh, they're transitioning children? That's awful. That should never happen. And I have this big disgust reaction. That's mostly the emotion that characterizes conservatives and people farther to the right. And I'm not saying it's bad. It's just kind of, I'm describing what's there. Mm-hmm. And on the basis of that emotion, I'll say, you know, all trans people are bad and, you know, we should never transition kids, right? They're making the same exact mistake, even though I think they're more right, as the progressives. And that's what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm. Segue.
Yep.
What about transcendence? What about moments of unity? Because what you're describing is a lot of front-loaded effort to think through things, to process things, to do procedural stuff. And your brain is suited to that. Your intelligence is suited. And you have to, you know, have a lot of downtime. You know, you have to watch and manage like your environment, because you know that you only have so much energy in the day, but you're very, 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 very smart, very intellectual. But what about God? What about love? What about that which causes you to not just feel a sense of humility and smallness, but connection with that which is greater than you?
Yeah.
And can your mind facilitate that? Can process, can procedure facilitate and comprehend that, those states of humanity?
That's a really great question. I actually rehearsed this morning in the shower.
Oh, well, there you go.
So over the past 3 years, I've done a lot of exploration on that front. I joined a local synagogue, and I go to the Shabbat service and the Torah study every once in a while. I've read a lot of religious literature. I've read the Torah. I've read the New Testament. I've read the Lotus Sutra, which is the foundational text of Buddhism. I've read a lot of the Quran. I've, you know, watched a lot of religious and theological and spiritual debates and read a bunch of different texts and different things like that, and gotten really deep into sort of Eastern psychological Ayurvedic medicine and things like that, which all is spiritual and it's God and stuff.
And is that motivated by curiosity or another kind of hunger, a hunger for transcendence, or just information gathering?
Initially, it was just for, I am curious. Maybe this will help me solve my problems in a more effective way. Maybe this will, you know, give me a leg up in a debate. Maybe I can understand the world better, because I think it's absolutely crucial for everybody. Read the Bible, read the Torah, read the Quran, read the Lotus Sutra, and more if you want, because there's some really crazy stuff in there. I'm not going to talk about the Quran because that could get me assassinated.
Jeez.
you know, like in the Bible, some dude gets swallowed by a whale, and there's a whole story about that. And it's like, what? That's interesting.
One guy was
mean?
Made fun of for being bald and called a mama bear to tear apart like 30 children.
Yeah.
Or something. There's a lot of cool...
That's pretty wacky. Yeah. And so what I've learned about religion is, A, religion is absolutely crucial for society to cohere, right? Mm-hmm. We see that across history. We see that across the world. I think one of the reasons we're divided right now in the US is because we don't share a religion, or we don't even have much religion. But I don't think that I could ever honestly say that I believe in a God or multiple gods, because there is simply a lack of compelling and or scientific evidence to prove the existence of a God or multiple gods. What I can say is that we do have a lot of evidence for things science can't explain yet, which are really interesting. For example, this is covered in Daniel Kahneman's book, Thinking Fast and Slow, is the staring effect. I think that's what it's called. Humans are more than 50% accurate at telling if somebody is staring at them in the absence of all sensory information.
You can just feel it.
Yeah, you can just feel it. Like, that's really interesting. There's compelling evidence to say that, you know, if you talk to plants with positive emotion versus negative emotion, they grow better. I think that we have a bunch of little bits of evidence to say that there are these little, I'm going to say, magical things, understanding that magic is science we don't yet understand, that exists in our world. And those little sparks of wonder, for me, that's the origin of any sort of spirituality you might say I have, because I feel compelled to seek these little sparks out and sort of appreciate them and maybe meditate on them. And, you know, once you start looking for things like that, you know, Jung talks about synchronicities, for example. Synchronicities, that's wonderful. I think we have all of these little suggestions of some spiritual or psychic phenomenon that are worthwhile investigating and worthwhile engaging in, because they're really cool and they make life exciting.
What about the creative pursuit? I can see the case that music is a way for you to understand yourself. It's also a job. It's also something that gives you pleasure and that gives other people pleasure, hence having a job in it. But in the creative process, are you ever astounded by something? Is there ever a sense of things fitting into place and you participating? Tolkien had this idea of mythopoiesis, that the creative act is a way of a creature participating in the creation of the creator. It's a way of you know, sharing a joyride with God in a way. You know, you're at one with that. I'm wondering if you ever escape beyond yourself through the creative process and then look back at yourself or look back at that product and see that wonder, that breaking open of the seam of procedure and knowledge and craft and mastery and expertise and pleasure and all that stuff. And you see something.
So perhaps one of the disadvantages I have in life, the drawbacks of being rather analytical, I'd say, is that what you just described while you were talking, I'm like, oh, this part of the brain does this,
okay,
which explains that phenomenon, and Mihai Csikszentmihalyi in like the 20th century from Hungary did these experiments showing this, this, and this.
Yeah.
But yes, I subjectively experienced that.
Okay.
What that is that's, I would say that's flow state. Part of flow state is when you're so deeply in this work, you have the sense of euphoria, number one. Number two, your prefrontal cortex, which modulates planning and sense of time and sense of self even, mostly deactivates. So in the truest sense, you know, neuropsychologically, you become one with what you are working on. And that feeling, which I can't really replicate in words adequately, is amazing. And I love that. And that's part of the reason why I like music so much, is because I can enter into that flow state pretty regularly when I have everything set up the right way.
Yeah. Do you feel like an obligation to mankind?
Yes.
What's your job here?
My job is to change the world in a positive direction. And you might ask me, okay, how do I know that that's the case? You know, is that a feeling? Is that a thought? And I'll just describe the subjective experience. I find myself multiple times a week. Maybe I'll be in a dream. Maybe I'll be on a walk. Maybe I'll be in the shower. And I'll have this feeling and thought that I'll be telling me, hey, you need to go out and do something amazing. You need to change the world. You can see that this, this, and this, and this is wrong. Or maybe you can see that you can add this, right?
Yeah.
For me, more specifically, I feel a significant duty to help others in my life. And I've always felt that way as long as I can remember. You know, I did that concretely in middle school when I worked in the nurse's office without getting credit for community service hours or paid or anything. It's just because I liked helping people. And today, with my experiences, I also feel like I owe the world something because I have so many privileges and because I have so many abilities that other people don't have, right? I have the experience of once thinking I was trans and then no longer thinking I'm trans and realizing the issues with that. And I feel a duty to help people and their loved ones who are in situations like that the best I can. Right. And that's the main reason I did our previous interview. That's why I've stayed, you know, more or less active in some communities to certain extents here and there. And that's why I've continued to talk about these issues with anybody who will listen, really, within some reason, because I don't want to get, you know, I used to be a bit more timid about things because I was afraid of actions taken by Berkeley to somehow censure me or discipline me based on my political views, which at this point, I really don't care. I'm honestly, if Berkeley wants to say, hey, because of your particular political view, we're disciplining you in this way, I will, you know, look them in the eyes and I'll say, do it right now. I dare you. And maybe I'm a little bit crazy for that, but because what I'll do in that case is I'll write an article and I'll email everybody I know who does interviews and podcasts and things, mm-hmm. and I'll talk a hell of a lot about it. And that'll be a catalyst for me to get the word out on why these issues are so important. Because the trans issue affects musicians at a disproportionate rate. I don't have any data. The data I have is observational and going to Berklee College of Music. So many of my classmates are trans or trans identified.
What is that about?
So I'll give you a sort of psychological statistical answer. Think about the archetype of a musician. Who wants to choose to go to a school to do music? People who have difficulty with emotions, number one. People who have unusually large amounts of emotional experience, people who are very sensitive, people who are non-conforming, maybe people who are a little bit nerdy. All of the descriptors which I just listed there also apply to young adults and teens and kids who are trans identified. Simply from the personality tendencies of musicians, you get higher rates of, being trans identified. And that's just how the numbers work out.
Yeah, but why be trans identified? Why not any other human phenomena, cultural phenomena?
Yeah. Because, so I'll start with talking about David Bowie and Prince.
Cool.
I'm sure that when you think about David Bowie and Prince, and when our listeners think about those two really famous musicians, one of the first things we think about is, wow, they wore makeup, how they look. What they look like was not typical of how men presented in their time or now, even. And, there are countless examples throughout history. A lot of the earliest blues singers and guitarists were rather, butch presenting women, like Bessie Smith, for example. That's more of a deep cut, if you will, because I study a lot of music history at Berklee College of Music, surprise, surprise. Mm-hmm. But that trend continues to the present and is always filtered through societal norms, right? At the beginning of the 20th century, if you're a woman and you're playing blues and you want to be gender nonconforming, you're going to go up there and you're going to wear a suit, right? If you're a man in the, 80s, you're going to wear makeup, right? Whereas 200 years, 300 years before that, men wore makeup all the time. And it was the manly thing to do. And tights were manly, right? Mm-hmm. Now, unfortunately, the gender nonconforming thing to do is to be trans. Or I think I can be more accurate with that.
Yeah.
I wrote about this the other day. The trans rights activists have tried to group as many people as possible under the trans umbrella. So, for example, tomboys. There have been articles, I believe, in like the New York Times, for example, written by people who are trans advocates saying that tomboys are trans, right? Saying that, feminine men are trans. And then, doctors and therapists say that, and then they're pushed down that route. When we see throughout history, a lot of the most significant contributors to music being gender nonconforming, of course, now we're going to have gender nonconforming musicians. And because of the society we live in, that gender nonconformity is not going to be seen as a natural sort of diversity or deviation, but as symptoms of being trans.
Yeah, which is very kind of black and white thinking.
Yeah, pretty autistic.
Yeah. I'm still fascinated with this line of inquiry, because why gender? And what I think of, like, just shooting from the hip music gender, it's got to be evolutionary. You know, it's got to be, it's, you can't decouple sex from gender or gender from sex. Like, there's something about the male performer performing femininity. It's not just homosexual or an autogynephilic expression. It's also a signal to women. It's also a way of, I don't know, ingratiating yourself. Like why play around with gender if there's not some sort of creative energy that's unlocked by playing with gender, and not just creative, but also procreative, because creativity and procreativity are very nested as well.
That's a great question. I think that, try to take a stab at that, and I'll say that creative people, which musicians are, like to push boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to find all of the boundaries, and we're going to try to push all of them. One of the boundaries that has always existed, and hopefully will always exist, is the boundary of gender, right? Not every musician pushes that boundary, right? Not every creative individual pushes that boundary. For Picasso, he was pushing the boundaries of what figurative art meant by sort of molding and manipulating what we could see as a human, right? Pushing that boundary.
Yeah, yeah.
David Bowie, you know, with his makeup and, you know, whatever effeminate style he may have had, was pushing the boundary of what it means to be a man.
Yeah.
And that's just kind of an internal drive. You know, for me, I'm really compelled to push the boundary of what a person in my situation in this day and age can do as a musician, right? It's like, I'm going to play all the instruments, I'm going to write all of the songs, I'm going to mix all of the tracks, right? And I'm going to make it work. And that's pushing a boundary, because that's not typically how people do it.
Yeah. But if everybody's pushing the boundary via transition, does that make it a boundary anymore?
So
aren't you like kind of double pushing?
You're enforcing the boundary.
Yeah.
Yeah. By saying, oh, because I'm this gender nonconforming man, that means I'm actually a woman, that constricts the range of what a man is, and then it becomes much easier to push the boundary of what a man can be.
Hmm. Could you unpack that? You kind of lost me.
Okay.
Which is that's my end, but
yeah. So this is a little bit complicated, and I just thought about this.
Okay.
There are multiple steps to this. If we're, as a society, saying that rather effeminate men, maybe, you know, disproportionately gay men and disproportionately autistic kids as well,
mm-hmm.
are not effeminate men, they're actually women, that means we're cutting off the effeminate end of men and boys, right? Mm-hmm. Thus constricting what a man is and can be. So we're making that boundary closer to the norm, mm-hmm. right? Because it's closer to the norm, it's much closer and easier to push the other way. And so for me, it's like, because I am a musician, because I am who I am, I'm very interested in pushing gender boundaries, right? And the way I do that is I can do it in my, you know, my bow tie and my blazer and my vest and my chinos and all that, and my earrings and my relatively long hair, being emotionally vulnerable in front of a room or a concert hall full of people.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the bar for being a gender nonconforming man because of trans stuff is so much lower.
Hmm. Yeah, but
especially but in my generation.
But for all the people who are trans identified, isn't that locking in? I mean, I understand the creative impulse to go there, but once you go there and you find that everybody else is there, you're like, wait, what? Wait, there's no more boundary to be pushed here.
Yeah. So this is where we return to our discussion about embarrassment, right? Embarrassment comes partially from shame, right? Shame tells you there's something inherently bad about me that means I need to hide. If you're trans identified and you've started your transition, whether it's social or medical, to go back involves shame, right? If you realize, oh, maybe this isn't the right thing, you're going to feel ashamed. Shame tells you to hide, and that's kind of a counter against any impulse you might have to go back. So number one, that's why it's really hard to desist after you've started. Number two, right? I mean, there's the sunk cost fallacy, obviously. And also, once you've medically transitioned, there have been studies on this, but I think your IQ drops by like 10 points, almost a standard deviation.
From what I know with child puberty blockers, it's absolutely scandalous how little data there is, but it suggests via the animal studies that there is a hit.
Yeah. Cognitive. I know some of the desisters, detransitioners, and I know personally who took tests before and after had very significant drops, around almost a standard deviation, which is the difference between exceptionally smart and average, which is crazy. So, you know, if, right, I'm a musician, I'm pushing the boundaries of gender. Whoa, that means I'm trans. It's going to be, you know, twice as hard for me to achieve the same success as I would before because, right, mentally, I have a lot of brain fog, right? My intelligence and memory are going to change. Number two, on the physical end, like, I know for a lot of the conversations and research I've done, if you're a guy and you take estrogen, your energy is going to tank. Number one, your muscle mass is going to go down. Your drive is going to change a lot. And you're going to have to, you know, you're going to have a lot of difficulty getting shit done. And that happens the other way around. If you're an anal female transitioning to be a man, where being on testosterone, from what I understand, feels great. It gives you a lot of energy and it gives you a lot of motivation, but it also makes you really angry, right? And having too much motivation can actually be a bad thing. Because if you're really, really motivated all of the time, just generally, if you get a bad idea, you're more likely to execute it.
Yeah.
And one bad decision can ruin an entire career.
Yeah. Well, and frustrated, so, if you can't maximize your ambition or implement it too. Yeah.
And it's just really difficult if you medicalize to do things.
Yeah. Well, it's
aren't people who do.
Yeah, there's like a trade-off between doing and being. That's one thing that not confuses me, but makes me sad for the generation that's been adopting this, adopting identity. It's like, who cares what you are? Like, what are you doing? Like, who cares who you're being? Yeah. Like, what are you doing? And if everything is poured into, I'm a trans, this demi thing, and cross race too, because I have to push that boundary too. It's like, okay, well, yeah. Do you sound good? Are you doing good in the world? Is the world better off for you being this way, or is this just
making
about
more money?
You know? Yeah, I guess making more money is a measure of something, but it's just that there's so much derailing of the artistic type of the genius. The genius is being eugenicized out of existence in your generation by these ideas.
Absolutely.
And those ideas are not just top down. It's a societal wide thing. And there is some evidence that it is top down, but it's bottom up too. It's like, this is cool. What do you think about the end of it being cool? Do you see signs of that in your generation or younger?
Maybe? I've seen a lot of signs, through, I read some articles, I've talked to kids, I teach, for example, I won't disclose sort of to what extent I teach, but I teach, I'm published in, you know, popular music pedagogy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I also have a lot of friends who teach. One of the things that a lot of people are seeing is that Gen Alpha and young Gen Zers are starting to think that a lot of this, you know, progressive stuff is really lame. It's stupid. And so, you know, I've had, you know, kids, you know, say a lot of stuff about like, oh, it's so stupid that, you know, people are trying to be men when they're women. That doesn't make any sense. Like, there's something about like just being a kid where once it's part of the school system as a kid and you're being taught stuff, right? You don't want to learn. Like, the cool kids in school don't learn,
or
right,
you
what
know,
is trying to be taught. They're going to rebel against
that. You don't
want to
learn, or you want, yeah, rebel against that in two ways, by not learning or by being smarter, like calling out the emperor for being naked, because then you're cool. And it's an easy
and
way.
That's, yeah, and so once it's crossed, because it's crossed the boundary from colleges and universities to high school, middle school, elementary school, that's the age at which kids will realize, hey, this is really stupid, in greater numbers, I believe, right? Because once kids and teenagers and adolescents start seeing it as a large authority telling them this thing is true, they're going to rebel against it, because that's what adolescents do. So I think there is hope. I think a lot of the younger generation and the younger kids, and even a lot of my peers, are starting to wake up and be like, hey, this is pretty stupid, you know? But it's going to take a really long time to properly dismantle or undo or fix or mend the damage that has been done. And it continues to be done, especially when you look at Harvard, for example, or, you know, even Berkeley, like every university and every college almost, except a notable few like Hillsdale and Austin, and, you know, things like that, have whole departments, you know, like 10, 20 people being paid six-figure salaries, or, you know, just under six-figure salaries to perpetuate a particular ideology and political stance, right? You can't just snap your fingers and make that go away overnight without some pretty significant pushback. So I think that the, you know, as a, you know, on an individual basis, what I have come to terms with is that this is going to continue for years, right? I don't know if it's going to get better. I don't know if it's going to get worse. But either way, what we need to do is we need to talk about it. We need to have empathy for each other. We need to see the nuance. We need to realize that we make mistakes in our reasoning too, even if we're right about the thing, right? Right. If you're going from emotions to logic, maybe you're wrong. Or maybe you're right.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that. So, okay, this is something about smart people. Smart people are really great at constructing arguments and rationalizing. That means that if my emotion, then logic, the logic part of that is stronger than your logic, even if you're doing logic first, I will seem right, even if you're right and I'm wrong, because I can argue better than you. That's one of the big issues with smart people, because smart people never meet somebody who can really properly argue them out of their stupid ideas, because they've become so entrenched and rationalized within them. And that's something, you know, different people struggle to certain extents, but I think like an average intelligence person would have the opportunity to have people who are much smarter than them argue them out of, you know, their misconceptions that are emotional than logical, or even have the evidence to start considering.
What are you up to then? You're doing school things, you're teaching, you're making music, but in this, here's the question. What prompted you to email me, or what was the initiative for that?
I'm happy to talk about that. I wrote about this and thought about this and been talking to my therapist about this. I've been really burnt out for the past month. Burnout is an emotion, right? Or a collection of emotions. And it tells you something. It tells you what you've been doing does not work, right? And so I spent the time to really look inwards and be like, okay, what was I not doing right? One of the things that was really grating on me, honestly, was seeing a lot of my peers, for example, on social media or in person, talk openly and freely without fear of consequences with their crazy batshit political views from my perspective, right? Like, that's really difficult. And feeling like, why can't I do that? And then I realized, okay, let's do it. You know, at this point, I'm ready to accept any consequences which might come my way. And I, you know, soft tested the idea. Like, last week, I posted a picture of Irreversible Damage by Abigail Schreier and said, oh, I really enjoyed this book. Two people DM'd of my over 1,000 followers on Instagram. One of them said, oh, it's really cool to see somebody at Berkeley talking about this. I really appreciate that. We had a little exchange and it was really nice. And then there was another person who DM'd me something like, say psych right now. I'm like, I thought it was a good book. I'd be happy to lend you my copy. And then she didn't even respond.
Mm-hmm.
So number one, that's the thing. Number two, last month, I think the top song on the Billboard hip hop and R&B, I believe, was a song where Ben Shapiro did a rap verse.
Yeah.
I don't know if you saw this. It was called Facts. It was Tom McDonald and Ben Shapiro, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
I honestly found it to be the funniest thing I have seen in so long. Do I think it was a good piece of music? That's a completely different question. I can dissect it another time, but I appreciate it for what it's a joke, basically. And that's what, you know, Ben said, I think. But it also shows us that there's a big appetite among musicians and music lovers for musicians and music that isn't super woke, for lack of a better term.
Mm-hmm.
My favorite musicians, from a musical standpoint, I completely disagree with politically. And that's a little bit uncomfortable for me, right? Two of them are trans, like Cave Town and Addison Grace. And I've gone to see Cave Town once, as I mentioned earlier in this conversation. I've seen Addison Grace like three times, I think. I think they're great musicians and I love their songs and I continue to support them. But I think that politically, it's like, what the heck, man? It'd be nice to see my political beliefs reflected in the people I choose to idealize as musicians. Because, you know, it's hard to, you know, look up to somebody or really fully appreciate somebody if they're saying really stupid shit. And so I just think there's an appetite for it.
You have to speak up, but what are you saying?
Sorry, yeah, what am I saying?
Way. Yeah, what are you saying?
Yeah, totally. What I'm saying is that, number one, I think that there is no case in which, I don't think there's any good evidence that I have seen or that has been published that medically transitioning is ever a good idea for anyone. Period. I think that we need to protect children and even adults who are gender nonconforming, who are bisexual, who are gay, who are lesbian, who are autistic, from the trans stuff. And I think that we need to be able to embrace gender nonconforming people without medicalizing them and pathologizing them, because that's what trans stuff is, number one. And in my music, I talk about gender nonconformity and being bisexual. And I'm not, you know, doing it through this trans lens, which gives me the ick whenever I listen to music that has that in it, mm-hmm. right? Number two. Yep.
Yeah. How do you express or explore gender nonconformity without or aside or without being anti what you say is the trans stuff? Like, what is gender and why is that salient?
Yeah. So gender, I define, it's not something you identify with. It's more of the set of social norms and traditions, et cetera, that are associated with the sexes. So there's the male part of being a man, and then there's the sex part of being a man, and then there's the gender part, right? And to be a man, in my opinion, right, all you have to do is be male and an adult. Boom, you're a man. Congratulations. Welcome to the club. The gender part is completely negotiable, but it's real in the sense that society creates a set of expectations and standards by which men act, think, dress, express emotions, etc., and same for women. And that's sort of the gender part. And what I like to do in my music is subvert the expectations we associate with the male sex, right? Despite, you know, having a lot of progressiveness in our institutions and in our culture, I think our stereotypes about the sexes are actually stronger and more ingrained than they've been than they were 20 years ago. I wasn't alive back then, but I've talked to my parents, and apparently, you know, it wasn't nearly the extent to it is today. And I feel that it's part of my duty as a musician to push up against that. Right. And so by unapologetically being gender nonconforming in the societal context I'm in, while also not being trans, there you go. I think that Harry Styles is doing a great job of doing that. Right. He had his, you know, famous photo shoot where he wore a dress with the caption "manly man." Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, there you go. Mm-hmm. And then a whole bunch of trans activists commented and said, this is appropriation of trans culture.
Oh, okay.
And what that is, what that response is, they're trying to enforce sexual stereotypes and gender.
Yeah. Just by using two-third genders to accomplish that. A special category that defines and reifies the original two.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that as well, from why I wanted to do this is that I wanted the opportunity to show to people, not just say, but show to people that I am committed to honesty, I'm committed to truth, and I want to do good in the world. And part of why I do that, or how I do that, is through my music. And it's kind of hard to articulate that in short form content, which is most of what I make, right?
Yeah.
And this is only sort of like a stepping stone, hopefully, in a long series of, you know, times when I'm able to talk to people and have good conversations and try to, you know, bring people in. Because look, whatever you believe, even if I really disagree with you, I can respect, you know, you as a person, and I can play a song for you, and you can enjoy the song, or you don't have to, but you can, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, we can have a good time together, and then we can work together and move forward to make a better future for everybody. And that's sort of idealistic, but that's kind of true.
Well, dude, you're 19. Of course, you're going to be idealistic, okay?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of my job. I'm simultaneously, you know. Yeah. I also want to say as well, another reason I did this is because I realized that I very deeply value intellectual discussion and politics and things like that. And I want to continue to engage in conversations like these in public spheres about issues which I think are important and other people think are important, and hopefully shed some insight and help some people in some way. You know, if I help one person, I'll be happy. Yeah. If I help 1,000, great, you know? Mm-hmm. And great. The business I'm in is content creation, you know, is media, right? Music is part of media. And you see a lot of people blurring the sort of line between actor and musician and director and writer and all these different things. I'm like, why can't I do the same? If I'm authentically approaching my love for media and my love for discussion and my love for music, then, you know, I think that people will respond positively to that.
Well, I have a favor to ask you.
Okay. Do you want a shout out?
Well, no, I don't want to shout out. I don't even know how that would work out. But so we've heard what Simon says.
Yes.
Do we get to hear what Simon sings? Do you have a song that I could put at the end of the episode? People can listen.
Absolutely. I have one song on Spotify, all the DSPs.
Well,
it can't be
copyrighted because then YouTube will come and smash.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Copyright.
I can send you a unreleased demo of something.
That'd be great.
Yeah,
because I think it's really important to not only hear what you think, but also,
or maybe I'll record a special version of a song for you.
Okay.
That, you know, has something to do with the conversation.
Yeah, let your creativity guide you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Simon, I have to wrap up the conversation because we're going away for the weekend, but thank you very much for reaching out to me. It's been wonderful to catch up with you. I really, like, you were very important. I kept on thinking about you. Like, I have to get this kid back on. It's really important. In my line of work, or for what I'm trying to accomplish here, to not just see one person at one point in time, but also like participate in documenting development of ideas and as new information presents itself and stuff. But you are at such a monumental stage of life. Like, what you did in the last 3 years is only going to be matched by what happens in the next 3 years for you. It's just like, this is a wide open territory. So I'm absolutely just honored that you thought of me independently and you reached out and gave me the opportunity to host you.
Yeah, of course. Thank you for having me. I feel like we've only like just touched the tip of the iceberg.
I'll have you back on. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I'll have you back on.
Awesome. Yeah. I might as well tell people where they can find me if they're interested.
That's the next question. So where can people find your content?
So you can find me on YouTube. You can find me on Instagram, and you can find me on, TikTok.
Yeah.
On YouTube and Instagram. I'm Simon Amaya Price, which will be in the title of this video, I presume.
Yeah. And then the link below. Yeah.
Yeah. And on TikTok, I'm Simon_BRYN, which is just my middle name. Mm. And my display name is Simon Amaya Price. And I have lots of music. I have updates about my shows and things. I also have a website, SimonAmayaPrice.com, where you can buy tickets for my next show on April 2nd.
Do you have albums out yet or in the works?
I have a single out on Spotify, Apple Music, Amazon Music, etc. It's called Near Miss by Simon Amaya Price. Mm-hmm. I'm currently working on an EP, an extended play, which is like almost as long as like half of an album, basically. It's mm-hmm. going to be like 4 or 5 songs that I'm working on right now. Mm-hmm. And I'm hoping to release it maybe at the end of the fall.
Oh, wow. Well, that's a great opportunity to have you back on.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you can shill your discs. Or I guess they're not discs anymore, but yeah.
I'm going to get CDs printed because I want to have a CD of myself.
You just want your own CD. Yeah. I have a few.
I love CDs music. Personally.
Yeah. You're still, do you have them in your car, like hanging on your rearview mirror?
Yeah. We have like just like a pocket by the emergency brake that has a bunch of CDs. I have a sound system and I have racks and racks of CDs, which I live with my parents and they have a passion for CDs.
Yeah.
But also from a musician producer standpoint, because I do a lot of production, it's really nice to have CDs because I can get high quality reference tracks from the CDs.
Oh, yeah.
Because if you download them from YouTube or Spotify, they're not as high quality and you don't get the dynamic range and the frequency and all these different things.
Yeah. Simon, you're awesome. Going to end the recording. Thank you very much. People are going to go check out your music. Please do check out your music. And thanks for joining us.
All right. Thank you very much.
told me that you wanna talk more, so I put you on my color-coded spreadsheet. I meant it when I said that I'm yours. Without you now I'm incomplete. Someone press Ctrl-Alt-Delete. You look handsome and ask a are made of quartz and beautiful Iowans, but recently they've hurt. You put me under spell, as witches leave sage on my lapel, as you say goodbye and wish me well. Witches leave sage on my lapel, so my jacket starts to lose your smell. Snowy day when we first met in November, the first kiss to remember, and after dark we went to the library. We danced next to Foucault, promised we'd take it slow. Looked handsome, and that's good. Your teeth are made of quartz and beautiful your words, and boy did they work. You put me on a spell, as witches leave sage on my lapel, as you say goodbye and wish me well. You put me under spell, as witches leave sage on my lapel, so my jacket starts to lose your smell.
Thanks for watching.